supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a very special show for you today, cats and kittens. When we get to the question of the week, we will discuss what to do if a toad hitchhikes in on one of your potted plants for the winter. It happens more often than you might think. But the big show today is an interview with the author of a brand new book on bees that we are going to entice you to follow along with online at youbetyourgarden.org, where we have images of these wild, crazy, and diverse pollinators. But right now, it's time to take your wild, crazy, and diverse phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dave, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Glad to be here.
Hey, glad to have you here, Dave. Where is here for you?
Traverse City, Michigan.
What can we do for Dave in Traverse City?
Well, on behalf of myself and a number of gardeners I know in northern Michigan, we're having trouble with squash vine borers.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not really sure I tried everything I can find in my Rodale Organic Gardening Pests and Disease book, and even checking Gardens Alive website. Let's see, what have I done? Rototilled in the spring and
okay,
fall.
Now, wait a minute. Rototilled?
To turn them up and let the frost kill some of them.
Now, wait a minute. I want to stop you right there. So we're talking a flat earth garden?
No, I've got raised beds.
Okay. I would urge you right away to stop tilling.
Okay.
It's bad for your soil. It releases nutrients. It breeds weed seeds. And that's not the way to attack this pest. But go ahead.
Okay. Well, I've also used row covers and left them on until the vines have started to bloom.
Okay.
I've injected BT, and I didn't have a lot of luck with that. I've tried to be vigilant about, finding the eggs, and I've even sprayed with BT and wiped them, but those little eggs are hard to find sometimes. My last defense was to use some beneficial nematodes and put those into the soil. And, darn if they didn't come back in greater strength.
So here's what's going on with the life cycle of the pest. Now, is there an outdoor light near this garden?
No.
Okay. Sometime early in the season, after you put your squash plants out, the squash vine borer only attacks squash with hollow vines, which is most of the squash. It's all of the pumpkins, all of the summer squashes. And what happens is there's a kind of an ugly night flying moth that comes into your garden in the middle of the night and lays its eggs right at the soil line, right where the vine kind of comes in and out of the soil. And the eggs hatch, and a very tiny caterpillar then eats its way into the hollow vine. And it makes such a small entrance hole that you really don't notice it right away. But it's inside munching away, eating the inside of the vine. So by the time you notice anything, the vine is typically severed and the plants are all wilting.
Yeah.
And you say you're growing in raised beds.
Yes.
And in Michigan, you have to get your squash plants out fairly late in the season, right?
Well, I usually do mine by seed. I usually don't put plants out.
Ah.
So I put my seeds in usually about mid-May.
That makes it almost impossible to protect the vine.
Okay.
So what I'm going to suggest is by the time we get to mid-May, you don't even need indoor seed starting equipment. But what I'm going to suggest, you can still start from seed, but get a couple of garden six packs, like they sell plants in the garden center, and get a good bag of soil-free mix. That's a combination of peat, perlite, vermiculite, and compost. Very light and loose. Fill the containers with soil-free mix, put two squash seeds into each of the little cells, and then sit the containers in like a bowl of water or a pan of water for a couple of hours, until they're totally saturated and heavy, and then leave them outside during the day, bring them back inside at night, you know, do that same thing, making sure they're saturated. And then when the plants emerge, then cut back on the watering, pick which one you're going to keep, cut the other one off with a pair of scissors, and let them grow in these containers until they get to be 6 or 8 weeks of age, maybe potting them up into a bigger container. Then when you put the plants into the garden, you can wrap medical gauze around the vine. And so that way, when you put the plants in the ground, there's going to be a physical barrier that will prevent the little caterpillars that come out of the eggs from eating into the vine. But I can tell you,
sounds brilliant. I can't wait to spread the news on that one.
Yeah, and if you want to go for the gold, get some indoor lights, do the seed starting indoors, learn to do it well, you'll never go back. It opens up a whole world of gardening for you.
Okay, great.
All right, good luck, sir.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Donna, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, hi, Mike. I'm the lady from Avalon who had called you 2 years ago about how to win the tomato contest.
Oh.
And we won 2 consecutive years.
Oh, that's great. What was the contest? Earliest, biggest, best?
No, it's really the tastiest.
Okay, good.
Tastiest. And for 2 consecutive years, we won with our heirloom brandy wines because I'd followed all of your directions. But this year, for some reason, we had no brandy wines to submit because they never ripened and we had very, very little flowering. And we assumed it was because of the intense heat we had. But I wanted to ask you how basically we can solve this problem, or should we move on to a different type of tomato?
Well, you're never going to predict the season. And although we did in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland area, we did have 4 or 5, quote, heat waves over the summer. It really wasn't that hot.
Oh, it was. I mean, none of our brandy wines were ready for our tomato contest, which is Labor Day.
Right. You might not be putting an equal sign between the right things. Now, where do you get your plants? Do you start them from seed?
We start them from seed.
And where's the seed from?
Usually we'll capture seeds, you know, from the prior year, or we'll buy them through one of the heirloom catalogs.
So there's no rhyme or reason?
No.
Okay. So then do you start the plants inside?
Yeah, we start them at the end of January, early March, and we put them out, you know, mid-May or so. Depends on how the weather's been.
It is not unusual with heirloom tomatoes to have a lot of big green tomatoes very late in the season.
Yeah, I mean, we're still getting brandy wine, but, you know, this was the first time that we didn't get brandy wine by Labor Day.
Okay,
I mean,
they
stopped blossoming and basically stopped ripening whatever was on the vine before that intense heat.
So where did you get your brandy wine seeds for this season?
My husband ordered them, I think, from someplace.
Here's what I'm going to suggest. You're absolutely right that when we get heat waves, the flowers on a tomato plant that have already opened up are not going to produce fruit. But it does not harm the fruit that's on the vine.
Uh-huh.
And new flowers will form when the weather cools down below like 94, 95. But brandy wine, although it does refer to a specific tomato, there is great variation in the world of seed. I have seen brandy wines from some suppliers that are rated at like 80 to 85 days to maturity. And I've seen other suppliers with brandy wines, all the pink, quote, original brandy wine, where they're rating the days to maturity at like 110 days.
Huh.
So one of the things you want to think about if you want to regain your throne, your crown, your red scepter is to buy seed from a variety of sources. And instead of maybe putting six Brandywine plants in the ground that all came from Seed Savers or Gurney's or Burpee,
yeah,
or any of the other players, to maybe have you have six plants, use six different types of seed. But look at the days to maturity. Stay away from ones that are like three digits. Seed from every company is different because it was grown out in different parts of the country. Don't be discouraged by this, but make it a cue for next year to include more diversity in your original source of your seed, and I think you'll have your crown back.
Well, thank you, Mike. You're just great.
All right. Good luck, Don, and call us back next year to say that the trophy is back up on top of your TV set.
We will.
All right.
So long.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind our listeners in coolish climes that it's prime time to plant new spring bulbs, last call to plant garlic cloves, and super double triple secret prime time to be collecting and shredding fall leaves for mulching and compost making. But don't go running outside just yet, because we'll be right back with bees that will blow your mind, what to do with a potted toad, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what can you do when you find a toad in your potted plants? We'll also take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time for a very special interview, and we hope you have your computer up and running at youbetyourgarden.org so you can look at the images as we discuss bees, an up-close look at pollinators around the world. All right, as promised, it is time to speak with our special guest today, Sam Droege, who is a biologist for the Pawtuxent Wildlife Research Center and co-author of a brand new, beautiful book called Bees, an up-close look at pollinators around the world. Sam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So just to set the stage, this is largely a picture book. You've got these amazing large-scale pictures of all these wonderful bees, not only from North America, but from all over the world. It seems bees exist on every continent where there's a flowering plant.
That's right, yep.
A lot of it is devoted to their beauty and their, let's face it, absolute weirdness.
Right.
And I also want to talk to you about the importance of native bees, but I'll start out by telling you that I am a fool for native bees. And every spring, I save the lives of tens of thousands, maybe millions of native bees.
That's excellent. That's what we want to have for everyone doing.
Because you live and work in the D.C. area, you know that I'm on the air in D.C. as well as the public radio show. And every spring, all up and down the East Coast, especially from the D.C. area, people write me horrified about ground nesting bees. There's these bees all over their lawn, terrifying their children. And I've learned over the years to go, and yet isn't it amazing that no one's been stung?
That's right.
And you can almost see them pause in an email. And they go, oh, that's right. And I go, these are harmless, ground-nesting, native bees. They either don't have stingers, or if they have stingers, they're not going to use them. And they're solitary bees, but it's like South Philadelphia. They're solitary bees who live in a tight urban neighborhood.
Right.
And they're ephemeral. They'll be gone in a couple of weeks. Just leave them alone. And they'll overwhelm you with food and flowers later in the season.
Yeah. Most of those bees are one of two species of Calides or cellophane bees. And what people are seeing are actually the males guarding the nest. They're waiting for a virgin female to emerge so they can mate with her. And the females are very work-like. They would not know that they had bees nesting in their yards except for the fact that the males continue the swarm when males have no stings.
So it's just like
females.
High school.
Pretty close. They look a little bit different, though.
So the males have no stingers.
Have no stingers. And the females, depending on the kind of bee, sometimes some bees are stingless. They'd have no sting any longer. And other times they, like many of our Andrena or digger bees, they can't actually penetrate our skin. So they may have a sting, but it's designed against other insects rather than against mammals or people like us.
I take a shortcut and tell people that if it's a native bee, that they're just not going to get stung.
Right. They're not guarding their nests, and the things that are stinging them are either wasps, like the paper wasps or hornets, or they're the non-native honeybee.
Right, exactly. I feel personally that most of the so-called bee sting deaths in the United States are due to yellow jackets.
That's true. In fact, most people call yellow jackets bees because they look
They look a little bit like
they
it.
They look more like a bee because they're bright yellow and black rather than the – a honeybee is actually not quite the caricature of itself because it's brownish and people ignore it much more than the yellow jackets.
Now, before we get into these great native bees from around the world – honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
People have a hard time with the concept that these bees are non-native.
So most of the honeybee group is Asian. So if you go to the Himalayas or the Philippines or China, you'll have several species of honeybees that you can choose from. The European honeybee has always been there. Mostly it's been Mediterranean. And its kissing cousin, the African or Africanized honeybee, is just really a subspecies that differs a little bit because the whole Sahara is in between those populations. So those are anomalies. The bulk of honeybees come from Asia.
Now, the book itself is like, it's truly just a celebration of how crazy these things look. And the only problem is picking out your like 20 favorites.
Right.
So you suggested some, and it turns out all of these photos are in the public domain. People can share these and educate kids about bees around the world.
Yeah, they're on our Flickr site if you just look up our name, and there's probably going to be links on the website. And you can download the entire book, essentially, and print them out at any photo shop. They do great quality work.
Most of the bees you and I are going to discuss right now, we are going to put up on a slideshow on our website. And the first one, as I was going through the book when I first received it, that blew my mind is a bee from Australia called the Minute Baldy that I will tell you on the air looks like it was carved out of that great glow-in-the-dark plastic from the 1950s.
Yep. they're tiny. These are, we're talking something that is maybe half or maybe a third the size of a grain of rice. So I think part of the book is all this diversity in sizes and shapes. And if you think of flowers, all the diversity of flowers, which we know, then there's an equal diversity in bees because they design these flowers. So in this case, little tiny flowers, little tiny bees, little tiny flowers in Australia have their own set of little tiny bees. Every continent has a similar set of minute bees that inhabit their lands.
I have been able to identify somewhere between 25 and 35 different native bees in my garden mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania.
Well, I tell people that every one of their yards has the possibility of getting 100 different species of bees. They're constantly moving around looking for good food plants. And if you plant the right native plants in particular, they particularly like native plants, some are locked into certain kinds, you can attract bees almost anywhere. Downtown Philadelphia is totally fine for native bees if you have the right plantings.
Okay, next. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. The bottle green cuckoo bee from Madagascar.
Yeah.
What a first of all, a crazy looking bee with a science fiction face, looks like the fly in the original horror movie in the 50s.
Yep.
And tell us about cuckoo bees.
Well, about 20% of all bees around the world, so we know there's between 20 and 40,000 different kinds, but 20% of them don't carry pollen and nectar. They simply lay their egg in the nest of another bee species. They're often very specific as to whose nest they're going to lay in. And then over time, what happens is that the host egg and the parasitic egg hatch out, and then there's this little cage fight underground, usually, because that's where they nest. And the parasitic bee wins, eats all the stores, eats the dead baby, and then emerges from that nest. So that's their strategy.
And how did the name cuckoo be applied? Is that what the bird does?
Yeah, well, yeah. So we have, and actually our native cuckoo from North America does not do this, but the European cuckoo is a nest parasite of other birds. So it lays its eggs in the nests of other birds and, you know, does all kinds of crazy things to kick out the young and become the sole bird that the host bird feeds. So there was no – it seemed like a great analogy. So we often use these words that are from other species groups to this very strange world of insects. So cuckoo is one of them.
And again, there seem to be cuckoo bees on every continent. This
yeah.
seems to be a widely dispersed kind of trait.
That behavior of being a cuckoo evolves many, many different times in many different lineages. So you can go to any continent, even Hawaii, which had only one bee species ever populate it, but now there's 60, and some of those evolved the cuckoo aspects too.
The orchid bee. Come on. This thing looks like those things that would refuel a plane in flight. It's got this proboscis that it's as long as its body.
Right. And sometimes some of them are longer. The ones we pictured are only about as long. But it looks like what you would expect.
Oh, you found this.
Yeah. So I was in central Guyana. It's the kind of thing you would, looking at a bee like that, you would expect it to pollinate orchids. It's so bright and shiny and metallic. But what's going on is that the ones that we caught are the males who are going to orchids specifically for gathering perfume. So the orchid provides a perfume. The male gathers the perfume, uses the perfume to attract the females. And then meanwhile, the females go back to these same orchids to gather just the nectar.
And again, this is not an unusual trait. There are many species of male bees that simply use the flowers to make themselves smell good.
Yes, and flowers are also producing scent so that bees can quickly find them in an environment that's actually, for a bee, is pretty tough to locate flowers. So it's that combination of color, and then scent is the secondary locator for, oh yeah, I like that particular flower, I need to find more. So they're using that to track things down.
And if I read this correctly, the orchid has evolved to actually stick pollen sacs onto the hind legs of the male bees as they leave and kind of send it as a little courier to the next orchid?
Yeah. So no orchid produces pollen that's useful or edible to bees. So most plants that are flowers have coated their pollen with all kinds of yummy, good bee food, but not orchids. They simply attract them with nectar or scent and then staple, in a way, this sack of pollen onto them so that it moves from orchid to orchid, and that's their MO.
And because this is You Bet Your Garden, because the other thing that we are crazy about with bees, right on a level with bees, is tomatoes. We have the now famous tomato-colored bee.
Right. Yeah, it actually just
from
shows
Chile.
Right, and it shows some of the color formations, and because tomatoes evolved in South America, it actually pollinates some of the tomato relatives that are in that part of Chile.
So why would it be the same color?
You know, the answer is, I don't know. This is a bee. Most of these bees have so many open-ended questions, and color is just a really big part of that. We almost know nothing about why bees are certain colors. Why are the orchid's bees green? Who knows?
Yeah. So we talked about a bee with a long nose. Mm-hmm. Now, is this the bee with the longest nose, the long-nosed sand lover, also from Chile?
Yes, it probably is. It's another...
You need extra pages to get this guy's nose in the picture.
Right. It's fantastically long-faced. In fact, it doesn't even look like a bee. And then its tongue, which folded underneath.
You've clearly photoshopped this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, you might suspect that, but this actually is pollinating flowers in the Atacama Desert, which is a super dry desert, and the flowers protect the nectar, which might evaporate, by making very long corollas. And so if you want to access that nectar, and the plant would then add a little pollen to you, you have to have a very long proboscis and face to get in there. And so that's what's going on. It's that coevolution thing.
The hemorrhoid digger.
Right.
That's mean. Who came up with that name?
Is
that
if you look at the scientific name, it basically is repeating that name. And if you look at the bee, you'll see that the rear end is bright red, whereas the rest of the bee is some combination of greens and metallic greens and some dark colors and things like that. Why does it have a red end? I don't know. This happens several times. There's a bunch of red-budded bees throughout the world.
Another page that I marked is the brown-belted bumblebee, mm-hmm. which is a cool bee, and bumblebees in general are fascinating.
Right.
I think bumblebees are our great chance at getting children not to be afraid of bees because they're just so cute.
Yeah, and you can pet them in the garden.
And so cool. And this bee was collected on the White House lawn.
It was. It was part of an event where it was Take Your Children to Work Day. We were invited to show what government scientists do with insects and that everywhere, even the White House lawn, insects exist. And there was this bumblebee, and we took its picture.
That's the other call we get is bumblebees and carpenter bees because mm-hmm. they're terrifying to people because they're chasing the
right.
people. And I go, well, you're near their nest or, you know, there's some reason that they're being afraid of you. But I said, have you noticed you haven't been stung? And they go, yeah. And I go, but maybe the bee, like, even headbutt you, right? And they go, yeah. And I go, that's all they got.
Right.
You know, there's nothing else. I mean, there's no ammo.
Yeah. So those are almost always male carpenter bees, which are – they're guarding a territory and in which several females might be nesting in your deck or something like that. And they are just little motion detectors. If you look at their head, it's mostly eye. And anything that moves, they come and investigate. They don't have a great handle on relative size, so to
they think
them,
they can take us.
Yeah. It's like, I better check this out. And so they'll move right up in front of you, and it looks like it's attacking. But the reality, they don't have a sting, and you can just grab them and show them to your cocktail guests, and you'll look like a true hero, fists of iron.
Now, finally.
Okay.
And I'm not sure there's an easy answer to mm-hmm. this, or it may be very simple. What's the difference between a bee and a wasp?
Yeah, not easy. So one way to think about this is bees really are wasps. So they're just a vegan wasp. They eat pollen and nectar. And the wasps are all carnivores. But if you go in there and do all the phylogenetic work, you see that they are just nesting right in the middle of wasps. And so because you have bees that don't carry pollen and nectar, they have no reason to be all hairy. So you can't use the fact that they're hairy or not, because the non-hairy cuckoo bees look like wasps.
And they're carnivores. They're eating other bees.
Well, if you ask an adult bee what it needs, it's going to sip nectar. And the baby bee actually still...
Well, sure, it's talking to the cops.
Right. Well, but the baby bee is still eating the pollen and nectar mostly of the other bee. So you could argue that while they might chew on the baby of the host bee a little bit, mostly they're still pollen and nectar feeders. So the rest of all the other kinds of characters is they're just technical, and it's so difficult to tell apart some of the wasps to the similar-looking bees and vice versa that when we're processing specimens, I have many students who do this, we process all the wasps and all the bees so that I can look through them and make sure that we don't mix that up. So
right, because there's really bees that look like flies. There's wasps that look like bees. There's flies that look like wasps
right.
and bees.
I get every month, I get a set of what is this bee pictures, and because I've looked through all the bee books and whatnot, and it's actually is a flower fly that's mimicking a bee. So lots of fly pictures come my way too.
All right. Well, we could go on forever, but my producer is pounding on the studio wall. Sam Droege is a biologist for the Pawtuxent Wildlife Research Center. He is the co-author of a brand new book that is highly recommended called Bees, An Up-Close Look at Pollinators Around the World. It's published by Voyager Press. We're going to have lots of pictures up at our website, You Bet Your Garden. And Sam, thank you for your work. I love bees, and it's great to meet someone who's out there cataloging them and interacting with them every day.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's great to be here.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will once again have the honor of hosting the Philadelphia Interfaith Hospitality Network's annual Empty Bowl Dinner to benefit families fighting homelessness on Wednesday, November 18th at the Lutheran Theological Seminary on Germantown Avenue in Chestnut Hill. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to save the toads and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And by HarvestRite. HarvestRite's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at HarvestRite.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. What do you do when there is something besides plants in the pots that you've brought inside for the winter? Namely, nature's best pest-eating beneficial, the toad. We'll get those toads safely outside to eat your bad bugs next season after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Laurie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm calling from Ambler, Pennsylvania.
Oh, very good. What can we do for Laurie from Ambler, just outside of Philadelphia?
I have a magnolia tree that's about 4 or 5 years old. We planted it when it was not too big, maybe 3 or 4 feet. And now it's, you know, it's growing, and it's been doing very well. But this, we went on vacation. We came back in September, and it looks like it's half dead. The leaves on one side of the tree that probably faces the south, are falling off, and the branches are dry. And this is a tree that usually loses its leaves like the last thing in our yard. It usually keeps its leaves pretty long.
Right.
But now it looks sick.
Okay, so you planted it personally?
Well, my husband did, yeah.
Okay. When the tree arrived before planting, was it in a pot or was it bald and burlapped?
You know what? It was in burlap. He went to a nursery close by and bought it.
Okay. And was the burlap and the cage removed?
Oh, I think so. I'm sure it was.
Okay.
Well,
okay, because if it was planted wrapped in the burlap with the wire cage still attached, which many nurseries will tell you to do, they'll give you a hard time if you insist on unwrapping it. This is around the age at which the roots trapped inside that bag would be girdling the tree and really begin to stress it. One way to tell if you inherit a property where a tree was planted recently, we had a great guest on the show who wrote a book about, quote, how plants work. She's a plant scientist. And her test was to take the tree in your hand and try to rock it. And if it moved back and forth in the ground easily, it was probably still inside its original burlap bag.
Okay.
So we don't know if the wrappings were removed, so that's one potential cause. Can you see the root flare of the tree above ground?
Yes, we can.
Okay, and is there any mulch around?
There's just compost, not real thick, but twice a year we probably put like an inch or so of compost around it.
Nothing wrong with that. Where do you get the compost?
From my backyard.
Okay, so you make it yourself.
Yes.
Is it growing in or near a treated lawn?
Well, my lawn is not treated. My neighbor's lawn is probably 10 feet away.
And how long were you gone?
Probably like two and a half weeks.
And
it was hot. We had some crazy weather. We had some heat, and we had some storms.
Right. We had a very unusual summer in the Philadelphia area in that we had a fair number of heat waves, nothing excessive. We had a totally great rain, just exactly the right amount, maybe a little extra, but not too much. But then towards the end of August, we went into what I call an invisible drought, and it didn't rain for like 6 weeks.
Right.
Is that when you were away?
Well, yes. We probably did not water this tree in August. That's probably true.
But do you normally water your trees?
Yes. Well, it depends how dry it is. We have watered this tree before because it was a new tree, and we have watered it. But this year we didn't.
And do you suspect that your neighbors may have had a lawn treatment while you were gone?
I don't know. I could ask him, but I don't know. You know, actually, it's possible, but you would have thought the whole tree would have gotten sprayed or whatever.
Well, no, it would affect the roots, but are you saying it's the side of the tree that looks bad is on your side, not the neighbor's side?
Pretty much. It's the south side. It faces kind of out, not toward him so much.
And the tree doesn't get any afternoon shade or anything like that?
It gets morning sun and probably afternoon shade, yes.
Okay. And since you got back, obviously, we've had good rains. Did you do anything when you got back and you saw the tree in distress?
We did water it again. You
okay.
Know, we put the hose on like real low overnight.
Okay.
And it just doesn't look like it's going to make it. At least half of it's not going to make it. And it's been a nice tree. It's been, you know, growing and had little white flowers on it. It was, you know, hate to lose it.
Well, you know, don't assume, but also don't overreact. Don't try to feed it or anything like that as it's going dormant. But you're not treating your lawn. The only mulch is compost. There's no treated grass clippings included in your compost making.
No.
And now we've got good rain. The tree is going dormant. There's really nothing for you to do other than sit through the winter. And when things green up in the spring, maybe you'll get a pleasant surprise and maybe only a small portion of the tree won't green up. And then, you know, you can figure out if you want to prune that part off or if you just want to give it up. Don't do anything now. Wait till the spring. And then if you decide that the tree has just suffered too much and doesn't look good anymore and you're going to plant another magnolia, plant it a little further away maybe from your neighbor's lawn.
Okay, that's a good idea.
All right, Laura?
Well, thank you very much.
All right, good luck.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Good to talk to you today.
It's good to talk to you, John. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. I have a question about some canna that I planted last spring.
Okay, where?
Actually, this spring.
Oh, okay.
A spring before last, my neighbor brought over four rootstocks of some canna she had, and I had seen them. I had never had them, but I always admired the plant, loved the way it looked. I was sure I'll stick them in the ground, so I put them in the ground, and boy, did they do great. They did fabulous. Grew, bloomed, they were gorgeous. So I knew I had to dig them up, or at least everybody told me I had to dig them up. So I dug them up, and I could not believe what had become of these little tiny rootstocks that I had put in the ground. They were huge. And I finally got them out of the ground, the four of them, bagged them up, put them in my basement, kept them damp, and put them back out this past spring. Well, they were so large, I was able to get nearly two dozen starts off of these things. Like an idiot, I put them all in the ground.
Yeah.
Now I've had some health issues. I'm no spring chicken. And these things have just grown like weeds. I mean, they're huge. They're taller than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got nearly two dozen of them out there. I don't think I'm physically able to dig them all up out of the ground.
Okay.
Is there any way that I can cover them or something I could do to where I don't have to dig them up this fall?
It depends on where you live.
Well, I'm about an hour south of Columbus, Ohio.
Okay. Do you know your zone? Is that like...
They say it's 5B.
Yeah. Canna lilies are tropical, what we call
right.
Summer bulbs. You put the roots in the ground in the spring. The plants grow rapidly. And even if they don't get sun, they are still fabulous plants. People don't realize this, but you can plant canna lilies even in partial shade, and you'll get this beautiful leaf structure. And in your instance, because they got enough sun, you get these fabulous tropical flowers on top. But even you have to admit the leaves were sensational.
They're gorgeous. That's my favorite part is the leaf.
And that's you don't even need sun to enjoy that part. So
right.
Where are they on your property? Are they in any kind of a protected area? Are they way out in the open? And are they
no.
Are they in a high spot or a low spot?
Okay, they're on a level spot.
Okay.
I have a privacy fence in the backyard,
mm-hmm.
and they are along the fence on the north side of the house and along the fence on the east side of the house, right along the fence.
There are two types of people with canna lilies. There are people who are always going to dig them up and store the bulbs inside. But there is another group of people who rely on a very heavy mulch to protect them. And the heaviness of the mulch depends on the severity of your winters, which you don't ever want to predict. You go by, you know, your USDA zone and what typically occurs. So what I'm going to suggest for you is maybe you want to dig up one or two or get a neighborhood kid or a friend to come over and dig up one or two. And these would be the ones on the edges, the ones most exposed, and put those in a bag. They would be your insurance roots. The rest of them, I would wait until frost, the first light frost.
Right.
And then what you're going to need to do is get out there with a bow saw or a machete and cut them off kind of right at the soil line, but leave maybe 4 to 6 inches of stalk behind. And then
okay.
on top of that, pile either topsoil, shredded leaves, or in this case, you can even use wood mulch as long as it's not any dyed color. And I would make the mulch 6 inches deep. really mound it up. If you can just get shredded leaves, you could use burlap over top of the shredded leaves or the wood chips.
Okay.
But no plastic, nothing that's going to smother. You want the ground to be able to breathe, and then in the spring, just rake it away.
Great. I sure hope so. That's a good idea about just digging up a few. I believe I could probably handle that. But I shudder to think what they're going to look like next year if there was that many this year. So.
Exactly. I always like to have that little bit of insurance in my back pocket.
All righty, Mike. Thanks for your time today.
All right. Thank you, John. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. What do you do with a toad in a pot of petunias? Taking the place of producer Alexis Landis this week is our ace production assistant, Stephen Drehobolt. Steve, would you get us started by reading this week's intriguing question?
No problem, Mike. Dave in Newtown, PA writes, I'm a longtime listener of your show and finally have a question for you. A toad has taken up residence in one of the potted petunias on my back porch. The pot is terracotta, approximately 6 inches tall and 10 inches wide. The toad has burrowed all the way down to the bottom of the pot. I've seen him there every day for a few weeks now. My question is, what to do with him now that winter's coming? I've never grown petunias before, so I don't even know how to winterize them. If I leave the pot outside, will it be too shallow to protect the toad over the winter? Should I evict him now while the weather is still warm enough for him to find a new home? Thanks.
Well, petunias are really frost-sensitive flowers, so if Dave wants to try to bring them inside to a very sunny window or put them under lights to continue the bloom, he better do it soon. I had all my begonias and pepper plants inside by October 10th this year. They do much better over the winter if they come in before they get a real chill.
Right. You fill your house with potted plants this time of year. But what about the toad?
Well, you know, my first reaction was to tell Dave to just take out the petunias and dump the dirt and the toad in a woodsy area somewhere so it could settle in for the winter. But I decided to double check with herpetologist Jim White of the Delaware Nature Society. He's the author of one of my favorite little field guides, Amphibians and Reptiles of Delmarva.
And did he agree?
Yeah, he said that it was still early enough in the season to just release the toad outside in a sheltered area, a place with lots of shrubs and trees, and the toad would either dig into the ground or find an old animal burrow to hibernate in.
Well, what about later in the season?
Well, Jim said that people who don't notice a hitchhiking toad until the dead of winter should dig a little hole outside in a sheltered area, about 8 inches wide and just as deep. Drop the toad into the hole and then cover him up with loose soil or shredded leaves. Don't bury him like a spring bulb.
Well, couldn't you just keep him inside like a pet?
Yes and no. If you discover your squatter during something like an ice storm or a hard freeze, you're going to have to delay a bit. If this happens, Jim suggests putting the toad into a container with some wet paper towels on the bottom until it's safe to put him out, which you should do as soon as you can go outside and dig that hole.
Wet paper towels. Why not a bowl of water?
Well, Jim explained that toads don't actually drink water. They absorb it through the skin on their bellies. So wet paper towels are a good way to keep the little fella moist. But this is just the suggestion for a few days. If you're going to try and keep him inside all winter, you'd need a good-sized terrarium with 3 to 4 inches of loose soil on the bottom, a nice big bowl of water for him to bathe in, and you'd have to feed him crickets.
Crickets?
Yeah, you can get live crickets at a reptile shop or a pet store. If the toad can't go underground to hibernate, he's going to have something to eat. Live mealworms might be even better if you can find them. But no matter what, you need to turn him loose as soon as the weather starts to warm up in the spring so he can go out and mate.
Well, do we know what kind of toad it is?
Newtown, PA is right near the border with New Jersey, so Jim feels certain it's a basic American toad. A little further south in Delaware and Maryland, it might be a Fowler's toad, which Jim says is very similar. Both species start out pretty small in size, but if they live for anywhere close to their possible 5 to 7 years, they can get pretty big.
So those little toads and big toads I see around my garden are the same species? the big ones are just older?
Yeah, and the bigger they are, the more pest insects they're going to eat. 1 to 3 times their body weight every night in spring and summer.
Huh. Well, you have said toads are the most beneficial creature in the garden.
A single toad can eat tens of thousands of pest insects every season. And the majority of that diet is pestiferous. Caterpillars, moths, slugs, cutworms, cuke beetles, you name it. So, in addition to providing a moist and shady spot for them to hide in during the day, the biggest thing you can do to get them to eat your pests is to not use pesticides. Amphibians like toads have very porous skin, and spraying chemical poisons in your garden can wipe out your natural pest controllers. Well, that sure was some interesting information about the great American toad, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to other toady treatises, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Oh, and don't forget to check out the great bee images that go with this week's interview. You'll find them online at youbetyourgarden.org. Well, yikes, my producer is threatening to be a dunk bee if I don't get my stinger out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, as long as you include your location, at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you will find the answers to all of those garden questions you are going to email us. Pictures of the great bees from the show today, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Lauren Elkins keep our website well-pollinated. Alexis Landis normally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, but she's home with a sick kid. So Ace Production Assistant Stephen Dre Hobel stepped in to save the day. Great work, Steve Arino. Our editor today is Al Banks, and I'm your cuckoo bee, Mike McGrath, and I'll be back to pollinate your airwaves again next week. Are indoor ladybugs any good at getting rid of aphids on houseplants in those homes? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss whether this Asian invader is a real lady or just a bad bug. Plus your fabulous phone calls.